All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for another joining us for another episode of Fox Wine and Witchcraft. Guess who's with me again today? We have Zach Fiesel with us for part three of Folk Magic. What are we doing for part three as I see you getting ready?
For part three, we're talking about Mary, the mother, but not just her as a Christian or Catholic, not just her in a Christian or Catholic context, but also as a representation of the goddess or the divine feminine. And then we'll also get into a little bit about the other aspects of the divine feminine. But let's start with who Mary is, was in the beginning. So Mary as an individual was a woman that God decided would be a good candidate to carry, quote unquote, the savior of the world. She was visited by Gabriel, the archangel. And for those of you who know the prayers of the rosary, the first part of the rosary is from scripture, the annunciation that Gabriel gave to Mary. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. Mary was born to a lineage of David. David was one of the founders of the Hebrew Canaanites. If, without going into too much detail, there's like the Canaanites and then the different tribes of the Canaanites, and then from there came the Hebrews. And then the Hebrews sought to separate themselves further from other social denominations. So you have the Jews. She herself was Jewish. She was a Hebrew. She was descended from kings, specifically the line of David. And as most of us know, she became mother to Jesus Christ. She also had other children after Jesus with Joseph. So Jesus did have half siblings. Now, Mary, this lowly, not peasant, but very, very much lowly individual in this society, was kind of seen, at least with everything that happened to her, was kind of seen as rebellious. Not that she chose rebellion, but it was kind of thrust upon her. She was not yet married. She was betrothed to Joseph, but she became pregnant before their actual marriage. So that is a whole scandal. She was about to be stoned and everything. Eventually she fled to go to the homeland of Joseph, which was Bethlehem. And then we have the story of the Nativity. But it's interesting to see here that we have God, who is creator of everything in this Judeo-Christian context, needing a female to birth this divine being. God couldn't do it on his own. He needed some kind of intermediary. That in itself reflects this idea of the need for a divine or sacred feminine. That even God himself, mm-hmm. in all of his power and glory, cannot create without his other half. Now, you could get further into this if you study Kabbalah in its proper context and not this like new agey form of Kabbalah and not like Kabbalah with a Q, but Judaic mystical writings and teachings from an actual teacher. You see this in the 10, not 10, I forget how many Sephiroth there are. You see this in the Sephiroth with the divine attributes of God and the sacred feminine part of that. God in and of itself has those things by its pure nature, but in our physical realm you get a little stuck in the corner or kind of tied up, and so you kind of have to follow the rules of the reality that you're in. And for us, that is you need a man and a, or male and female to make a child. So out in the ethers, God could do all this by himself. Down here, he needed Mary.
Which is kind of interesting because science has now said that women, like if they use our bone marrow, I think it is, like beings can be created out of our own bone marrow. Like technically male is not needed.
Right. Well, we have like genetic tracing. A lot of it goes through the female lines, or you can track more or less your entire genetic code through just the mother's DNA. I'm trying to, what is it? Maternal mitochondrial DNA is a way how like we discovered Eve, you know, the very first woman, modern human at least. Then you have, I believe it's called parthenogenesis, which is where in certain lizards, the female can make clones of herself if there are no males around, and create offspring. And then most fetuses begin their life as female, genetically and physically female. And then further on, they become male. So there's a lot of beginnings that can only happen or do happen with just female, with the feminine aspect. So we also have this idea that Mary is not only mother to Jesus, but mother to all. You know, ask yourself, why did the Catholic Church so heavily have this emphasis on Mary? Well, the Catholic Church in its beginning was not affiliated with Christianity. It was more or less a government creation in Rome. That's not to say that there wasn't some kind of veneration toward the Mother Mary before Roman Catholicism, because there was a time after Jesus's death and before the Vatican, before the, I guess, lineage tradition of St. Peter. So St. Peter was, well, this is even debatable on whether it was Mary Magdalene or St. Peter who should be the stone of the church, but there were these early desert fathers and early practitioners of Christianity that were more or less loosely organized. They were more of a cult of Judaism than they were their own religion. And Catholicism didn't begin as a religion. It began as this government institution. And that is something that you can look up on the Vatican website. But Mary is seen as this feminine aspect of God. And again, the Catholic Church, because they were in Rome, were like, okay, we have this, these male figures. We have God the Creator, we have Jesus Christ, we have all these male saints. The Holy Spirit was kind of seen as male in the sense that it was a divine presence that came from God, but also sometimes seen as kind of transgender or non-binary in the sense that the Holy Spirit wasn't one gender. It was both and neither at the same time. It was outside of the spectrum. It was within the spectrum. It was in the middle. It was like this all-encompassing thing. It didn't have a gender. The Catholic Church, like I said, being Roman, we're like, okay, we have all of this male representation. Where's the female representation? We need some balance here. So that is where Mary came in, and the cults of Mary and the veneration of Mary. A lot of Catholics are very quick to tell people, we worship God, we venerate Mary and the saints. To most practitioners of folk magic, there's not a big difference. Worship and veneration are kind of seen amongst us practitioners of folk magic as pretty much the same. We can put them into like a hierarchical positioning, but it's more or less treated very similarly.
I remember in the beginning of my time in Catholicism where it was like, you know, God says, you know, you shall not worship anybody before me. And then I'm like, we do an awful lot of praying and, you know, veneration to Mary. you know, for not taking a god before God. So yeah. I never really got really good answers when that question was brought up.
Right. And like, there are very few rites that are associated with Christ or God. We obviously have, in the Catholic Church at least, Mass, or in the Protestant Church's communion, and in the Eastern Church's liturgy. But Mary has a rosary. The saints have chaplets. And yes, there's like the chaplet of the Holy Blood, the chaplet of Divine Mercy, etc. These were all created after the rosary, though. The rosary came first. And the rosary is, it started as a way to count the recitation of the Psalms. So in the very beginning, a lot of ordained monks and just the monastic orders in general would begin their day by reciting the Psalms, or part of the Psalms, and then basically from morning to night, all of the Psalms would be recited, all 150. The lay people took interest in this and wanted to do something similar, but because they were not nobility, and they were not learned or educated like the monks, they resorted to reciting Our Fathers. So they had these long strings of beads known as Paternoster beads, because that is the prayer that would be recited, the Paternoster, the Our Father. And 150 beads with 150 Our Fathers became kind of where the rosary started. So after that, we have peasantry and pagans kind of still clinging to their goddess worshiping ways, and saw the scripture about Mary, or were taught the scripture of Mary, or the scripture that talks about Mary. And that is where the beginning of the Hail Mary came in. Gabriel's Annunciation to Mary. Hail Mary, full of grace, etc., etc. So this was then recited instead of the Paternosters. There's some conjecture on how the actual tool itself came about. Some say they were beads. Others say they were flower crowns, essentially, these garlands of flowers that would be tied or twisted together. And with each flower, this praise to Mary, or this praise to this mother goddess in the guise of Mary, would be recited with each flower. And so that's also another way that we get the term rosary, this garland of roses. And it wasn't until much, much later that we have the standardized rosary that we have now, and the Hail Mary that we have now. So the rosary changed throughout history. It went from a way to recite these Psalms to this praising of Mother Mary, this praising of the goddess. And then it became very heavily Catholicized. So where this was kind of this amalgamation of pagan and Christian worship, it became standardized by the Catholic Church. And recently we've kind of gone back to this amalgamation of goddess worship and Christianity. And you have to realize a lot of folk magic is in these non-white communities that were colonized or forced to be assimilated into Christianity, specifically Catholicism. So in Mexico, for instance, you have this worship of Our Lady of Guadalupe. If you ask a Catholic, they'll say, oh, that's Mary, as she appeared in Mexico to Juan Diego. If you ask an indigenous person, they say, oh, that's Tonantzin, which means our mother. the whole story of Our Lady of Guadalupe is that she was this collection of these various mother goddesses of Mexico who appeared to Juan Diego, an indigenous person, and said, you know, I am here. I wish for a temple to be built here in my honor. And it was a way of these old goddesses blending into the current religion so that they could be remembered. And on Mount Tepeyac, where this miracle occurred, we have these roses that grew. We have the presentation of the roses to the bishop commissioning the building of the church. And now we have this space where these indigenous people who still carried on these traditions, albeit in secret and hidden in Catholicism, have a place to go and outwardly seem Catholic, but everyone kind of being in on the secret that they're actually petitioning and giving thanks to this Earth Mother. So as I mentioned before, the term rosary, it comes from this garland of roses idea. There's similar mythology or lore for the creation of malas. So malas are like the Eastern prayer beads, Eastern here as in Asia, India, China, Japan, etc. And these came from the same idea. These garlands of flowers would be strung together, and these would often be placed around images of deities or venerated teachers, gurus, Brahmins, etc., as a way to honor them. And from that garland of flowers, they made this string of beads. And that was another way to recite the name or the mantra of whomever they're honoring on this circle of beads, instead of having to get flowers, string them up, and place them on their image as an offering. So both malas and rosaries come from these ideas of these garlands of flowers as an offering. Now, with most indigenous communities of at least the Americas, there is, again, this blending of Catholicism and folk tradition or folk religion, where the recitation of the rosary isn't necessarily to Mary or this Christian goddess, but it is more to the indigenous mother goddess. In our case, or in my case, I should say, Tonantzin. Then you have certain practitioners who don't recognize themselves as Catholics, and they still pray to this image of Mary. And at least in Mexico, they're known as Guadalupanos. They're not known as Catholics. They have this strong devotion to Mary, but not necessarily Christ nor the church. I would consider myself a Guadalupano because I don't practice Catholicism. I was never baptized into Catholicism. But I do work with this dual goddess that is both Mary and who is the Earth Mother. And many people are starting to not only recognize that that exists, but also starting to practice that themselves.
I feel like I should be jumping in more, but I'm just like listening to it and kind of like crossing it over to some of like what I remember of Catholicism time. And then like in the Peruvian tradition, because there was such a Spanish influence, right, when they came over, that even like the Pachamama despachos, like it's very much a lot of flower working, mm-hmm. you know, in there. So similar yet different.
Right. Most images of Our Lady of Guadalupe, at least, will have all of these flowers arranged around her image, like in the picture, not just necessarily actual flowers. And that is, she is sometimes called, Mary in general is sometimes referred to as the rose, but the rose takes on this heavy symbolism in Mexican tradition as being almost like a physical, obviously a physical representation, but almost as like a physical touchstone or physical emanation or incarnation of Our Lady of Guadalupe / Dona Ancien herself. Roses are very, very sacred in Mexico and in Mexican folk magic. You know, a lot of people associate the rose with love. It is associated with far more things in folk traditions. And in my experience, especially with Mexican folk traditions and folk magic. All right, so let's move on to the divine feminine in general. So what are your experiences with the divine feminine? So we talked about your Catholic upbringing a little bit. What about now?
You know, if anybody has looked at the store's Instagram, you know, they may have seen a picture of my mesa. Mm-hmm. And on that mesa, there is a statue of Mary. And, you know, a little side story for that, like I argued with her at one point, you know, went to Holy Love Ministry just because they are very open-minded to other paths, right? So to go in and to experience the energy of divine feminine, divine masculine in one place equally, and was just kind of sitting there minding my own business, if you will, waiting for students to kind of finish their thing. And, you know, she starts telling me to embrace my Mary. And I'm like, first of all, my name is not Mary. Second of all, I am not Catholic. I don't do your Catholic shit anymore.
Yeah.
We're not doing this. And, you know, she was just very persistent. And I ended up, I think like a week later, like I argued with her for a week about this and she won. I went back, grabbed that statue. It sits on my mesa. And before I do any big working for healing or whatnot, before I even activate the mesa and call in the elementals, I'll do a rosary, but I have changed the prayer. Because for me, she's more of divine feminine and like a Sophia than just the Christian Mary.
Right.
So I've changed some of the wording, you know, Hail Mary or sometimes Hail Sophia, please be with me, you know, and parts of the others, just because I'm like, no, I don't like automatically assuming that I am of sin and I am wronged. And, you know, and I'm like, we're going to change that because I truly don't believe we were put here to automatically be misbehaved children, right? No. So I do a lot of working with her when it comes to my Mesa work in asking for her guidance in, you know, where to find the healing work that needs to happen. The client might say one thing and maybe they're even unaware of what the deeper issue is. Maybe they haven't gotten there yet. And she has been very helpful in doing that. So I mean, that's kind of my working, you know, with her. Right now, my Mesa is actually set up at my store. And there's been a few people who know that we're more pagan, you know, and then they'll go, well, why is there a Christian deity on your Mesa? And I'm like, well, what had happened was. So, yeah, she's not the Catholic Mary to me that way.
Right. So with creating this kind of your own rosary, a lot of that, so especially in my generation, the millennials, those of us who have interest in folk magic or magic in general have come to having this devotion that has only kind of recently been recognized to Mary. You know, a lot of people, when they come to, you know, the metaphysical or, you know, the quote unquote spiritual, are coming from Christian backgrounds because that is the general overarching religion in America and in most of the world. So they're entering these pagan and these earth-based religions with still a subconscious lens of their past Christian life. And I think there's some kind of comfort and familiarity in seeing Mary as something other than her Christian depiction. And so, again, a lot of my generation, at least, have taken to making not only just their own physical rosaries, but making the rosary their own in a way that they can relate and connect to this mother energy and this goddess. For instance, I've done that. So, as you know, I love olive wood, and I created my own rosary with twisting together cotton strands, or braiding rather, to create a cord, stringing it with olive beads from the Holy Land, and then attaching the Our Lady of Guadalupe medal instead of a crucifix. Then I've also taken to rewriting the rosary itself. So for instance, my Hail Mary is, Hail Mother, full of grace, you are whole. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, creation. Holy Rose, Mother Eternal, pray for your children now and at the hour of our death, or at the hour of our return if you believe in reincarnation. So a lot of, again, like my generation at least, have taken to dismantling their upbringing and dismantling this acknowledgement of women being powerful, but also still seeing them as having to fulfill these submissive roles, because that's what Catholicism did. And finding this connection to this mother energy. All right. So we've talked about Mary. We've talked about Don Ensim. We've talked about Pachamama. She's prevalent, at least this mother goddess is prevalent in most religions, and I would venture to say all religions, even the minor ones, you know, the tribal ones, the ones that aren't talked about so much. But in Tibetan Buddhism, which I am a practitioner of as well, we have Tara. We have many female Buddhas, but Tara is the one that most people would first encounter. Tara is seen as savioress. She is seen as liberator. And there are 21 versions of Tara. And again, you know, you have the Mass for Christ, but you have the rosary as this handed down tradition to Mary. You know, we have the sutras and the tantras of Buddha, but we have the 21 verses to Tara that have been handed down as well. Every female deity of creation or of the earth kind of has these traditions that continue and go on and are more accessible. So for instance, you know, practicing the tantras, practicing the sutras, most people can practice the sutras. The tantras, you have to have permissions for. Tara has tantras that you need permissions for, but the 21 verses of Tara, the 21 praises of Tara, are open to anyone. Anyone can practice and recite those verses. Whether you should do it in English or your native tongue or in Tibetan, that's kind of up to you and your teacher, but it is generally agreed upon. Anyone without the empowerment, without the lung, without the instruction, can recite these 21 praises and receive benefit from her. She is one of the bodhisattvas that comes to anyone who calls out their name. And with Tara, we also have the Dakinis. So Vajrayogini is kind of seen as the ultimate Dakini, but the Dakinis are, there's so many translations for Dakini. One of them is like fairy or angel, and I'm like, some New Ager translated that. But in my opinion, I like the translation of muse, spiritual muse. The Dakinis are literally translated mean sky goer or sky dancer. And they are sometimes elemental, depending on like what you're looking at, most of the tantras, you see the Dakinis as elementals, kind of like guardians of the five elements. Dakinis are these female spirits that inspire practitioners and inspire masters equally to do certain things with their practice or to go certain places. And the interesting thing about Dakinis is they can sometimes be trickster. So we have this, you know, up until now, what we've been talking about is this motherly energy. Dakinis represent this guiding energy like a mother, but also this temptation energy, which is also a female attribute. Most of the times we see women as being temptresses in a very evil way. So for instance, Mary Magdalene. But in Tibetan Buddhism, the Dakinis, there's this famous phenomenon called the call of the Dakinis or the song of the Dakini. And basically it's their tempting of these great masters to leave this world behind, go to other worlds and teach the Dharma there. So kind of abandon humanity because you're going to be further respected over here in this pure realm. Most good masters who are very well trained in their bodhisattva training would say no, but there have been masters who have agreed. So while we are talking about this caring, loving, motherly energy, we have to understand that females and women aren't just this monolith of caring and giving. They also have this power to be kind of the opposite. And I think there, when you see those two things, we can start looking at the mother and goddess energies as whole instead of just this nurturer.
I was going to say, I mean, if you could say that that's that motherly energy caring for that master and kind of going like, you would get better benefit over here. Like, wouldn't that be what a mom would do?
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I could see it related that way. Darn it. Like every time I unmute myself, all this background noise is going on. Sorry, guys. You know, so then it would be up to the master, in this case, the student, or, you know, to, or your son, to make that decision really for yourself. Yeah. I'll go over here where mom says to go, or no, I'm going to stick it out and keep going harder. Mm-hmm. You know, so I could kind of see that motherly thing both ways in that attribute, speaking as a mom.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So, do you have any other personal experiences with the Divine Mother or with the Rosary?
You know, I find at times when I do the Rosary, and if I'm really concentrating, in the beginning, like I'm like, oh my God, this is going to take forever. Like the old Catholic in me, like, God damn it. but now it will fly by without me even having to go very fast on purpose. And I guess I fall into such a type of trance that I end up yawning a lot. And when I mentioned that to Zane, my teacher, and he goes, oh, he's like, that's a very trance type of state, and you're probably getting ready to fall. Because I'm like, I will get really cold and start, you know, yawning. And he's like, yeah, you're almost there.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but the other part of me is like, don't fall over.
Yeah.
I would be sitting on the floor in front of, you know, my mesa. So I have experienced that, you know, every now and then, if I'm doing the work pretty regularly, 2-3 times a week on a consistent basis, like I will start dreaming with her and having messages come through. But like with everything going on, my move, and this is why, guys, so sorry, our regular listeners who notice that there's like a 2-week gap, like moving and then no internet and shenanigans. So we're back. We'll be back to a regular schedule now. You know, not so much. Like it would take me some work to get back in there, to kind of get back into mama's good graces, right? Of being consistent and working with her.
let's see, my personal experiences with, so the interesting thing, again, I'm speaking from a Mexican folk magic or folk religion or folk tradition practice, is you have Our Lady of Guadalupe Tonantzin, and then you have another popular saint, Santa Muerte. And these two kind of go together in the sense that one is life and birth, the other is death and returning to the earth. My experiences with Guadalupe, a lot of the signs have been very similar to Santísima Muerte. Once upon a time, I did work with her. I worked with her for maybe about 1 or 2 years, and then I passed her on. But there are two sides of the same coin. And with Our Lady of Guadalupe, she has come to me in the signs of coyote, which is kind of seen as more of a Santísima thing. She has come to me in the signs of owls, again, which is another Santísima thing. These are still her, though. And where my relationship with Santísima Muerte was very transactional, with Our Lady of Guadalupe, it was very non-judgmental, very not always quick to happen, but definitely very reliable. The things that I would ask, or even giving, like, you know, proper offerings, or, you know, just general gifts, they'd always be received with some kind of sign. So it was more than just transactional, like it was with Santísima. With Tonantzin, it was very recognized, and it was very like a mother. It was, I don't want to say reciprocal, because it was more of me asking for things or just giving offerings, but they were always acknowledged in some way.
Now, did you have, like, did she tell you it was time to pass on working with her, or was this like a conscious decision on your part, like maybe in your Buddhist studies, or?
So with Santísima Muerte, that could be a whole episode in and of itself, but she, I had her for about 1 or 2 years, and I've learned a lot with her too. One of the biggest things is you don't use Santísima. You should never use her to get your way. You don't just start honoring her and venerating her just to get a wish fulfilled. There came a point where I told her, I have nothing else that you can really do for me. And there was never this feeling that I got or intuition that I had of, I just fucked up. Because our relationship, again, was always very transactional. There were never signs that she wanted to work with me. There were never signs that I should be working with her. It was, I am going to try to start a relationship with this folk saint and see what comes about it, and go about it in the most honorable and respectful way that I can do that. At the end of it, I basically told her, like, I got nothing else. and she was like, that's chill. So I gave her final offerings just as a, like, thank you. Wrapped her up, put her in a box, asked one of my friends who, incidentally, I messaged that day and was like, hey, would you be interested in working with Santísima? And he said, I asked this person specifically because his whole life he had been surrounded by Latin American individuals. And so he was more or less immersed in this culture. And I asked, would you like to work with her? And he said, definitely. Funnily, today I've said her name like 3 different times, or she's come up like 3 different times in conversation. I was like, okay. So we met, I handed him the box and all the tools involved in it. And I said, this is how you set it up. These are some prayers. Here you go. And nothing bad has happened to me since. Everything has gone very well with him and her. So I don't want to say that I got off easy on any of this. Again, she's not someone you just go to. And there are ways that you go about doing that. Did I do it the best or most proper way? Absolutely not. But I did do it in a way that, again, was honorable and respectful. Mm-hmm. So just because I said, these are the things I did, please do not go and do those same things.
And don't do the
exception. That. Like, I was the exception here. Like, that, for, I feel like for anyone else, that could have ended very badly.
Well, I mean, I think the fact that you weren't doing it, like you said, just to get an end result. And I mean, you were pretty respectful up to be like, you know, versus like packing up, moving on.
Yeah.
You know, leaving in the middle of the night, running away. Yeah. You know, I think there's something to be said there. Are there many? I can't think off the top of my head. Any female deities where you should do like a whole closing exit, you know, ending ceremony? And maybe that's because I've never bothered looking for one, but yeah. I can say that I've ran across.
The thing with Santissima is rarely do you get to have an exit. You're usually stuck with her for life, especially if you go to Mexico and you undergo like the bloodletting rituals and stuff that kind of like cement a bond with her. Or you make a deal with her where you do a skin sacrifice where you like dedicate a spot on your skin to have a tattoo of her. You're stuck with her for life. I didn't make any of those promises. Any of the promises that I did make to her were things that were within my ability to do. Hey, I need this amount of money by this time. If you get it to me, I'll buy you a bottle of wine. That is very, you know, cut and dry. Bottle of wine gets presented, that deal is done. There's nothing else to go on from that. There are people who will do like the skin sacrifice or, you know, bloodletting rituals. The bloodletting isn't so popular for obvious reasons. No one likes to get cut, but those are usually for life-threatening situations. And even then, there are many works to do to help save your life that don't require that. It's more of a societal initiation, in my opinion. But yeah, I never made any grandiose deals or deals that I couldn't come through on my end with. So it was always kept as, I don't expect more from you than I can give, and she doesn't expect more of me than I promise. So again, I don't want to say I got off lucky. I just kind of was really smart about this. And please do not just pick her up and start making deals with her.
It's funny that there's a couple of customers that when they come in, we have some Santa Muerte items right in the store available for whoever might need.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll come in and they're like, I love your store, but I get a little uncomfortable down that aisle, like about halfway down. I don't know why. And I'm like, yeah, why? What's going on? And one of my colleagues is like, because Santa Muerte is in that aisle, you know? And I'm like, really? Like, that is so off-putting, really?
She likes to challenge people. So she doesn't have any racial hangups, but because she comes from a very specific brown community, Mexicans, she's kind of a protector of those people. And if you even look like you pose a threat, because she has a very fiery spirit, she will make you feel uncomfortable. If you have connections with death or work with like Persephone or Hecate or the Baron or Papagete or, you know, any of these death, you know, even St. Michael, any of these like psychopomp or death spirits, the intensity isn't so bad because you're already used to that. But if you're always working with like, especially if you're a beginner of any practicing, you know, kind of witchcraft, and you're like a beginner who's doing what they should be doing, like cleansing and protection, and you haven't really gotten into like spell work, you're gonna feel that. She is a very powerful presence. And I think because she can be scary in that way. People label her as evil, you know, aside from the fact that people are like, well, it's death, so it's satanic cult and, you know, worshiping of, you know, the devil, etc. She is off-putting to those who are a little naive, maybe immature. She's off-putting to those who look like they could pose a threat to her community that worships her. And she can also in and of herself be trickster. So she will challenge and fight you. You know, she's not necessarily looking for a fight, but it's like, if you're kind of weak, you know, have a weak disposition or a weak composition, she'll take advantage of that and she will terrify you.
It's funny, like I've never had a calling to work with her. I have worked with Hecate. She was one of my first ones. And she still pops up now and then, but I've kind of seen all of the different female goddesses of all the different pantheons. Like to me, I equate it as they all come up to the same one type of energy deity, and they're just the different personalities and what you need, you know. You know, I'm a shop owner, I'm a podcast host, I'm, you know, all these things, but yet it's still just me.
Right.
You know, so I guess in a way, you know, and this could just be my ego talking. So in a way, I have worked with Santa Muerte, but in a slightly different form. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the artwork of hers, and, you know, but I've never felt drawn to do it. Kali, like I know a lot of people are threatened by Kali. I think she's pretty badass, but I've never felt the need to go work with Kali or who else, you know, just these darker, you know, considered, and I say that with air quotes that nobody can see me do because this is a podcast, darker, you know, goddesses. Because I'm just like, what's there to be afraid of, right? We all have our own dark, and I hate that whole, it's so overdone right now, the dark and yeah. The shadow side of personality. But it is true. I mean, we all have that not so pleasant part in learning to work within in a productive manner. Mm-hmm. Yeah, tangent. Let's get back on track.
Nowadays, because I had once upon a time a relationship with her, if I see her stature or whatever, I just kind of give a nod. Or I've had maybe a handful of instances where she's not really known to do this. So maybe I'm missing something here, but I like to think it's her. Where she shows up right after something that would normally occur with her. There have been times where, like, just missed an accident. And then, you know, we park wherever we're going, and there's a full skeleton of a dead animal. And that's kind of like a nod to her. I don't think she's doing favors for me. For all I know, this could just be my ancestors or the Grigri that sits in the car for, you know, to keep us safe. But sometimes it's like, I like to think that she's still somewhat present because I once upon a time had a relationship with her. Or like even hearing owls, I'm like, okay, that's probably Don Ancin. But what if it's Santa Muerte just saying hi again? Not that she wants to work with me or that I want to work with her, but it's just like a hey. Because that is something that is known of her. She can be persistent or like lingering. But she also isn't one to necessarily go out of her way for anyone not a devotee of her. So it's one of those things that's like, when they happen in the moment, my intuition isn't up on par. So it's like, I don't know what this is or who this is. So it could just be me pulling or reaching for sticks here. But when I'll pass her statue or whatever, you know, I'll look at her and nod, you know, as like at least an acknowledgement that we had a pass together. You know, I don't think any worse of her. I don't think any higher of her either, because I, you know, I only worked with her for like 2 years. I don't know to what extent she can go. But yeah, it's nice to have like a passing acquaintance with her now.
Now, back to the whole rosary part. How would you say rosaries and like witches' ladders not workings? Are they, would you consider them similar in any way, shape, or form?
A witch's ladder, because usually it's like, what, 13 knots or 13 feathers. They're similar. You're reciting a prayer or an incantation or a spell with each knot or feather that you put into a witch's ladder. So I would say they're similar. The other thing is Mary has a darker version of her rosary. It's called the Seven Sorrows Rosary. And then Santissima herself, her practitioners came up with a rosary, and hers, funnily enough, is very similar. So you can get the Seven Sorrows Rosary with the typical decades. Or there are versions where the beads, the decades aren't decades. It's not 10 beads, it's seven. With Santissima Muerte's rosary, it's the same situation. You can get rosaries of 10 beads and say her rosary, but typically you're going to find them in the decades being seven beads instead of 10. So if you want to work with Santissima in a dark way, you can, you know, honor her with that rosary. Or if you want to work with Mary, but a more shadowy and, you know, really sad and like angry version of Mary as protector, you could do the Seven Sorrows Rosary. So some resources. For those of you who want to read more about the history and the modern kind of de-Catholicized practices of the rosary, I suggest the book The Way of the Rose by Clark Strand and Perdita Finn. For those of you who want to learn about her in the Mexican context or the folk magic context, I recommend the book American Brujeria by J. Allen Cross. He gives the rundown of the rosary as well as praying the rosary, where the mysteries aren't the typical Catholic rosary of the typical Catholic mysteries, but are mysteries related to Our Lady of Guadalupe, Don Ancin. He also does talk about the Seven Sorrows Rosary in that book. For those of you who want to learn a little bit more about Tara and the Dakinis, I would look up Sultram Alioni. She has a couple books on that, The Divine Feminine, The Sacred Feminine, and Buddhism, as well as Dakinis. And her, I don't want to say her main shrine, but it's like a retreat. What is it called? The Tara Mandala Center. Obviously, the name Tara is in there, but like that center all around the walls are the 21 Taras, and they do pujas to each of the Taras. With the COVID pandemic, they were doing pujas to, I believe, the 20th Tara, who deals with contagious disease. So yeah, Sultram Alioni is a good reference for Dakinis and Tara, if you wish to look into that a little more. But those are some good references. Do you have anywhere anyone can look for Pachamama?
So I know Inca Mountain Magic by Zane Kerfman. That's actually my teacher in his book. Any of the books by Elizabeth Jenkins. She actually was training in the same timeline as Zane. So they have a lot of similar teachers, but her books give a little more history and interviews with some of, I think just recently, one of the last Pacos that she had worked with for her books, like, had just passed. Which was sad. Yeah. But, you know, Elizabeth Jenkins, who also teaches, and I believe she lived in Hawaii. So if you go learn, like, you get to go to Hawaii if you want to learn from Elizabeth Jenkins. And she teaches a little more of the feminine mysteries, too, of our tradition, which Zane does a really good job. And a lot of the tradition is heavily feminine anyway. So one of these days, I may venture down to Hawaii and be like, What's your take here? What do you have to teach me? But any of Elizabeth Jenkins' book, Don Zane Kerfman book, and his is Eka Mountain Magic, which is normally available in our store and on our website, but you know, will be. If it's ever out of stock, it's coming in again. So just throw a message and we'll set one aside when the shipment comes in. So.
And there's also different resources for like doing magic with rosaries that I just can't think of right now. In American Brujeria, he does go over like a couple workings that you can do with a rosary.
There's another, I think it's called like Pagan Prayer Beads, which is a Llewellyn publication title.
Yeah.
We really have that one as well. So, I mean, they're pretty interesting. It's always fascinating to me how many different cultures have similar practices with slightly different names, but they kind of come down to a similar result at the end.
Yeah.
For meditation, self-empowerment, getting into connection, giving veneration. We just call it this while you call it that.
Right. I definitely encourage everyone to like, if you get interested in the rosary and take it up, make your own physical rosary and then rewrite the prayers that fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of built-in power because these prayers have been recited for so long. But you also have a personal power that comes about when you make and write your own.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good point. I was a little nervous at first to change that prayer, right?
Yeah.
That's a Catholic prayer. What's going to happen if you change that prayer? I'm like, oh yeah, I don't believe in that hell anymore, but I'm scared to do it.
Yeah.
But now it just rolls off the tongue so easily. And I find myself while doing it, if I slip back into the old way, you know, it's a quick mental, like that was a change that came through. What's the message, you know, while still going through and like, oh, okay. And then keep going. So it's, I'll catch myself even slipping back into the old tried and true Catholic prayer. Damn it.
But you don't even have to, like, if you don't want to rewrite an entire rosary, get a rosary, but like say Tara's mantra on that instead of saying Tara's mantra on all of these, you know, you can definitely interchange some things there. So
you can definitely do a lot of good spell work with them. Rosary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get creative. Cool. Well, thank you for your knowledge this time around.
Of course.
You know, us recovering Catholics always comparing traditions and knowledge. Zach, you are available at times in store. So if you're in the Cleveland, Ohio area and you look up Goddess Elite and you might want to come in and meet the man in person. You are available in store, but if they're not going to be in Cleveland, how do they get a hold of you?
The best way would be through Facebook Messenger. Look up Red Cloth White Candle Brujeria, RCWC Brujeria, and I should pop up. If I don't, look up my name, Zach Fiesel. The other way would be through Instagram. I am at TIOCUAHUITL.
How do you say that?
Tiokwawit. It means cedar in Nahuatl, my indigenous traditional language.
You know how many times I read that and I can never remember you saying it? And I'm like, I don't know, but that's Zach. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. We're going to be back to our regular schedule of posting now that the move is done and I have reliable internet, so things are great. But we look forward to you joining us on our next episode. What's going to be part four?
I think we're done with this series.
Okay. I wasn't sure if there was a part four or yet more to come.
Nope.
Okay. He says now, but there could always be a message at 3 a.m. like, I got a part four.
There might be a continuation on my personal Facebook page. So keep an eye out for that.
There we go, guys. Go find him. Go like him. Go friend him.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you for joining us and we'll see you next time.
Bye.